From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with one of America's most prolific and respected film directors, Sidney Lumet. His movies include Network, The Verdict, Dog Day Afternoon, Prince of the City, and the soon-to-be-released Running on Empty. Also today, we'll talk with the producers of Running on Empty, Griffin Dunn and Amy Robinson. The pair also produced John Sayles' movie Maybe It's You and Martin Scorsese's After Hours. Rock historian Ed Ward traces the rise of America's top R&B label and its first big star. And if you've ever been humiliated by some snob who's caught you on an arcane rule of grammar, you have an ally, our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Sidney Lumet is one of today's most prolific film directors. He's known for being fast, dependable, and frequently under budget. His movies include 12 Angry Men, Long Day's Journey Into Night, Failsafe, Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Equus, The Wiz, Prince of the City, The Verdict, Daniel, and The Morning After. That abridged list will give you some idea of the range of his subject matter and style. Lumet's new film, Running on Empty, is scheduled to open in September. Christine Lottie and Judd Hirsch star as a couple who in the late 60s bombed a government-funded napalm laboratory and unintentionally blinded a janitor inside. The couple has been living underground ever since. Their 15- and 10-year-old sons have grown up on the run with their parents, constantly changing homes, changing names, even hair color, to elude the FBI. Much of the story is told from the perspective of the older son as he comes of age and considers coming out from the underground. Sidney Lumet has directed about 40 films. I asked him how he got to make this one.
It was a fairly usual setup on this one. The studio had been developing it for about a year. I was under contract to the studio, and they were about to put it into what we call turnaround, which is... We don't want to do it, fellas. See if you can get a deal at some other studio. And at that point, I'd just heard about it, discussed among a couple of people, and asked to read it, and I did. So it was fairly straightforward.
What about the story appealed to you?
I think the most important thing to me in it is the moment of breakup, really. Between parents and children. Naomi Foner, who wrote the screenplay, said a remarkable thing one day when we were working on the script. She said that parents and children are the only love affair in which you can measure the success of it by how well they break up, since the breaking up is inevitable. And I was very moved by that, and find, certainly among my friends and my own life, that that is not an easy point in one's life. And I think it was that primarily that drew me to the script.
Two of the main characters in this movie are people who were radicals in the 1960s and have since been living underground. Do you think it was an advantage or a disadvantage for you to not be of that generation?
Probably an advantage. I think the fact that I wasn't interested in making a nostalgia piece about the 60s probably did the picture good, because it seems to me that fundamentally what it's about is something that's so much broader. And even though most good work comes out of its specificity, and I think we are specific in the movie, I think the fact that I'm not of that generation, that I'm older than that, served as... Well, let's put it this way. The 60s can be an enormous distraction. There's an awful lot of life about it that's very attractive, and yet would not particularly be germane to the story we were telling, even though the political action of the parents clearly was. So I think all in all, an advantage.
Mm-hmm. You've made about 38 movies in a little over 30 years. And it reminds me of the old studio days in a way, when there were a lot of movies being made, many more than there are now, and when directors and actors used to do a lot of movies per year. How have you managed to keep that pace up, especially considering how the movie industry has changed?
Lucky, Terry. I love work and I love movies. I think if I could ever, and these things are clearly impossible, but if I could have had the artistic freedom that I enjoy now, under the old studio system, which would have been impossible, by the way, I think I would have been very happy working in a studio, because I love going from one project to another. I love when I work with actors who I find exciting to work with. I love repeating with them and working with them again and again.
So you think of yourself as having more artistic freedom now than you did when you were starting because of how the movie industry has changed?
Not partially.
Or because of your stature.
Part of it is muscle. You know, yeah. you get a couple of hits behind you and you can slowly start encroaching into that area. But I think you're right. I think the studio system has changed. I don't think that Louis B. Mayer would have given me Final Cut no matter how many hits I'd had. He would have never given up that prerogative.
Now, you insist on that, right? When you take on a movie, you must have Final Cut, which means what exactly?
Well, it means that there can be nothing. The film cannot be touched after you finish editing it,
mm-hmm.
Whether in the soundtrack or visually. It's yours.
What kind of problem had you run into with previous movies that taught you needed to demand Final Cut?
Well, as an example, many, many years ago, I did a very, very interesting picture. I think a very good picture. It's one of the few that I like better now than at the time that I did it. A picture called The Hill with Sean Connery. And it was not much of a success in America, but a good picture. And at that time, I did it for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and at that time, they were being owned by a new person. They were changing hands almost daily. There were three new managements in the period of a year. And at one point, they just said it as a matter of company policy that a picture had to run 1 hour and 55 minutes because they thought that this would work well for their relationships with the exhibitors. And the picture ran 2 hours and 2 minutes. And they just insisted that I take 7 minutes out. They didn't care where it came from. It didn't matter to them that there were no 7 minutes to take out without destroying the movie. And it was a hell of a battle, and the only reason I won it, actually, was because management changed hands again, and the new management came in, which was listened with slightly more sympathetic ears. But if the old management had continued running Metro, they simply would have taken the film and removed 7 minutes, period.
Right.
And that kind of thing goes on constantly. A great many directors have suffered very severely from that.
And that's still going on.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My guest is film director Sidney Lumet. His movies include 12 Angry Men, The Pawnbroker, Serpico, Prince of the City, Network, The Verdict, and a new film which opens in September called Running on Empty. Let's talk a little bit about your first film, made in 1957, and this was 12 Angry Men, a courtroom drama. You had before that been directing television, live television dramas. Was this a good transition to make since it was basically a one-set movie? It's a courtroom drama. It's a jury drama. They're in the deliberation room most of the movie. Was that a good place to start?
It was good, and it was a great problem, except that I was dumb enough not to know what the problem was. I found out after I had done the movie and people liked it that it was very difficult to shoot a movie in one room. That never occurred to me.
Really?
I had just plunged in with complete ignorance, knowing what I wanted to do with camera, knowing that I could make the camera a good interpretive part of the movie itself, and just blithely went ahead, shot it in 19 days, happy as a lark, and didn't know what the problem was. I may have felt enormously secure at the confinement of it, because my background, as you say, had been live television and the theater. So the idea of staging something in one room was something that came very easily to me.
Well, the movie starred Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb. Fonda is the only juror initially convinced of the defendant's innocent. Cobb is the last holdout. I want to play a clip from this movie, 12 Angry Men.
Maybe she honestly thought she saw the boy kill his father. I say she only saw a blur.
How do you know what she saw? How does he know all that? How do you know what kind of glasses she wore? Maybe there were sunglasses. Maybe she was farsighted. What do you know about it?
I only know the woman's eyesight is in question now.
She had to be able to identify a person 60 feet away at night without glasses.
You can't send someone off to die on evidence like that.
Oh, don't give me that.
It's a heck of a cast. In addition to Fonda and Lee J. Cobb, you have Jack Warden, Jack Klugman, E.G. Marshall, Ed Begley. You directed them your first time out on film, and you've since directed Paul Newman and younger actors like Al Pacino and Treat Williams. Is there a difference in the acting styles of the actors who you were directing in the 50s and the actors who came of age in, say, the 70s?
Not really, Terry. The basic craft of acting is, in the United States, has been set for some years, really, even before the method came in. Basically, people like Fonda worked out of a profound sense of truth. In fact, a man like Fonda didn't know how to do anything falsely and used himself brilliantly. Both of those elements are foundations of the method, and even though he wasn't called a method actor in the sense of having studied the method, he basically worked out of that, as most good actors did.
Do you think of yourself as a method director?
No, I become the kind of director that becomes whatever his actors need. When I did Murder on the Orient Express, I could work the way the English actors work. When we did Long Day's Journey into Night, there was a perfect example. Kate Hepburn has a very specific way of working, her own technique. Ralph Richardson is a prime example of British technique, which is primarily from what we call the outside in. Dean Stockwell works completely method from the inside out, and Jason has his own glorious world of creating something from inside himself, and heaven knows where it comes from. But I think part of the job of directing is to not make the actors work your way, but for you to work as a director any way that makes them comfortable.
You directed Al Pacino in two of his first big movie roles, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. I want to play a short scene from Dog Day Afternoon, and maybe you could tell me what you think Al Pacino needed when he was getting started. This is a scene from the very opening of the movie when Pacino walks into a New York bank and he holds it up and he wants the money to buy a sex change operation for his lover.
Nobody move!
Get over there!
Okay. All right, get away from those alarms.
Cut!
Now get in the center. He moves. Take his head off. Put the gun on him. Get out of the center.
Sonny? I can't do it, Sonny.
What?
I'm not gonna make it, Sonny.
What are you talking about? Put it on.
I can't do it, Sonny.
Sal, what? Where are you? He can't make it.
It's an interesting performance because Pacino is so manic in it and yet so insecure and incompetent at robbing this bank.
Mm-hmm.
What did he need when he was getting started? You were talking before about giving actors what you think they need.
Primarily what he needed was, this is going to sound like an anachronism, and it was, he needed a great sense of freedom and a great sense of restriction. The creation of the character is really Al's own. He understood something about that man that is irreplaceable, and I don't think a director can ever give. He understood him down to his bone marrow. What he needed was a sense of release, the confidence to know that as extreme as he got in the performance, that it would write, that it went. For example, there's a scene toward the end of the movie where he's talking to his female wife, his real wife, on the telephone, trying to decide what to do. And the scene is extraordinary in the sense that it requires a level of emotion that I've seen very rarely in movies. We did the scene in one take with two cameras, because I didn't want him to have to repeat that emotion over and over again. And when he finished it the first time, it was wonderful. And without waiting an instant, I didn't even cut the cameras. I said, Al, go again. And he looked at me like I was crazy because he was exhausted. He was spent. And I said, right now, action. And what I was driving at was that he had reached such a height at the end of the first take, such an emotional peak. But that's really where I wanted the scene to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the best pieces of movie acting I've ever seen. It was blinding in its intensity, agonizingly painful, and just reached a level of emotion that I don't think I've seen often in movie acting. And that knowledge that he could go as far as he wanted to within the confines of this situation and that man, the situation created by the script, the man created by Pacino, but that confidence to know that he could go as far as he, as his feelings would carry him, was very important to him. And that was really the biggest single directing relationship to his performance.
That's an interesting story. Now, you mentioned there that he really did it very well on the first take, but you wanted that emotional spentness to be the starting off point, so you had him do it again. Now, you're really known for doing a lot of performances on first and second takes, for not going for a lot of takes. I wonder if you ever run into conflicts where there's one actor in a scene who works really well on that first or second take, and another actor who sees it as their style to go for 15 or 16 takes until they really get it perfect. What do you do if you run into that?
I have run into it, and so far, if there were a piece of wood around the studio, I'd knock on it. But so far, I've been able to convince the 15 or 16 take actor that the other works. The early takes are not imperfect. They are usually the freshest, truest. The repetition I find, and I think for most good actors, the repetitions tend to become mechanical. One doesn't find more truth in it as it goes on. Now, that partially has to do with the way I work, because, as you know, or may know, I rehearse very heavily. I rehearse 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the complexity of the characters, before we begin. And those rehearsals are conducted like theater rehearsals, in the sense that people learn their lines completely, are working without scripts, they're completely blocked, to the degree that we're having run-throughs by the end of it. So it's not as if once we get on camera, that this is their first exposure.
Is that uncommon?
Yes, it is. It is. It is not done often. I think mostly those of us who were trained in television do it. I think Arthur Penn does it. I know Arthur Penn does it. John Frankenheimer and so on.
Oh, because you had to do it for the live drama.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And but it turned out for all of us, I think, in movies to have other advantages.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk more with you about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director Cindy Lumet. His movies include 12 Angry Men, The Porn Broker, Serpico, Prince of the City, Network, The Verdict, and a new film called Running on Empty, starring Christine Lottie and Judd Hirsch, which opens in September. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Sidney Lumet is my guest. Now, you really came from a theater family. Your father acted in the Yiddish theater. You acted when you were very young. I think you either performed in or a standby in the Dead End Kids on Broadway?
I wasn't one of the Dead End Kids. I was in the play. There were other children's parts.
It was a play called Dead End on Broadway. Okay.
Right.
Now, did this experience with the Yiddish theater via your father and your own performances help you understand actors as a director?
I think so, Terry. The biggest thing about actors is that they really are the infantry. They are the most exposed. And most good work, not just acting, but really any creative work, is a matter of use of self, self-exposure. And as I say, actors are the infantry in that. It's their emotions, their physiognomy that's being examined, rejected, accepted. At the actual moment that they're doing it, they're right up there.
Why did you give up acting for directing?
I found that process very invading. When I got out of the Army, I'd been acting since I was 5 years old, and I got out of the Army in 25, and at 25, and went on with it for about another 3 years, and I was primarily a theater actor. I knew that good acting, as I say, is self-exposure to a large degree, and I got sort of embarrassed about revealing those parts of myself to 1,500 strangers a night. If you were in a hit, that is. Otherwise, it was to 50 strangers a night. But there was something about acting that no longer worked for me, and I just slowly drifted into directing.
Did having a father in the Yiddish theater help you love performance?
Absolutely, drama? Absolutely. The peculiar thing is there's a sort of strange post-World War II American problem. Children of actors and writers and directors tend to be nervous and upset. And more than nervous, they're terrified of going into their parents' work. And yet the history of the world is going into your parents' work. I mean, in England, in the Redgrave family, Natasha now is the fourth generation of that family that's become an actor. And fortunately, it's beginning to make some sense in America. Two years ago, I did a movie with Jane Fonda and Jeff Bridges, and I had worked with both of their fathers. I'd worked with Henry and I'd worked with Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very moving. I was thrilled at working with the two of them because that sense of continuity is lovely. It's the way it should be. And I'm quite sure that my father, being the actor he was and bringing me into the theater at a very early age, was an enormously beneficial and happy-making thing to happen to one.
I want to play another short scene from another movie you directed, and this is Network, which came out in 1976. Peter Finch won a posthumous Academy Award for his performance in this. And in this scene, he plays a lunatic, self-styled, messianic broadcaster who is basically preaching his editorial.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, damn it! My life has value! So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And right after, as he's doing that editorial, people all over Manhattan in high-rise apartment buildings open up their windows, stick their heads out, and start yelling that they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. I thought that scene really tapped into something, and for me what it tapped into is the fear is that in Manhattan there's so many high-rises filled with so many people with all this pent-up anger, and if it was ever let loose, we'd really be in big trouble.
Well, Paddy Chayefsky had that unique ability to tap the most fundamental truths in people. In the individual characters, and also in terms of the situation that he was observing. Did you ever see a picture that he wrote called Hospital?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's hilarious as Network is with fundamentally a deeply serious idea behind it, and he did it in that too. I miss him every day.
Network was one of your many movies that was shot in New York locations. Now, I think you were really one of the first directors to actually do location shooting in Manhattan.
Yeah, Kazan first and me right behind him. But at that time, it wasn't fashionable at all. It was very difficult to put together more than one good movie crew because there was that little work going on here.
Why did you want to shoot on location in New York?
Well, once you were shooting in New York, there was almost no choice. We had very limited studio space in those days, so that you had no choice. But also, it coincided clearly with the kind of picture we were doing, which were usually very realistic pictures, pictures that benefited visually from being done on location.
Were there problems when you were one of the pioneers doing that, since crews weren't used to it? The people on the streets weren't used to having movies shot outside their homes or their offices.
Yeah, but they were all good problems. The problems are much more severe now because everybody's so sophisticated. So they not only charge you a hell of a lot more to use their facility, but they're also a little bit more contemptuous and irritated by the inconvenience that shooting makes. In those days, it was glamorous. People were amazed by it, were diverted by it, enchanted by it, so that the problems in those days were actually less severe than the problems now.
You know, between 12 Angry Men, The Verdict, Serpico, and Prince of the City, you've done your share of police and legal dramas. Is this a special interest of yours, or did you just like those scripts and want to do them?
It's funny, Terry. You know, I don't really analyze these things. Mm-hmm. I just respond instinctively to a piece of material. But obviously something in me somewhere is very involved with that level of life. Where it comes from, I don't know. But on looking back on it, boy, there are an awful lot of what I call justice stories. They somehow involve me very viscerally.
Have you been affected by the new craze of market research?
Yes, and fortunately, I've had my artistic controls in place before they ever came along, because I think they are disastrous. I think they're destructive. I also think they're untrue. I think a person changes as soon as you ask them something.
So do you have a no market research clause when you take on...
No, because I can't prevent the studio from doing it, but mm-hmm. I sure in hell don't let it affect any of my decisions about what I'm going to do with the picture.
You obviously love film directing. When you're doing a movie, what's the part that you most look forward to and the part that you know you have to do but you really don't enjoy at all?
There's only one part that I have to do. All of it is a thrilling process to me: pre-production, shooting, post-production, editing, music. The only part that's a bit of a drag is what we call the mix, which is when we come in and do the final soundtrack and put every chair squeak in and every door slam in. It requires enormous concentration because it's largely a mechanical process rather than a creative one, although some directors use it very creatively. The soundtrack that I keep remembering particularly is the soundtrack of Apocalypse Now, which was a brilliant piece of work and a totally creative piece of work. However, you do have to do it. I feel I have to do it myself, because if the mix is a bad mix, if the wrong thing is emphasized, it can seriously affect the movie and be very destructive to a movie. So I have to do it, but it's the only non-joyful part of movie making to me.
One last question. You've just finished a movie, which is about to be released, Running on Empty.
Mm-hmm.
Are you working on another one now? What's the next step for a busy film director like yourself?
Normally, I would have been shooting by now. I would have maybe even had a picture finished by now. Unfortunately, the writer's strike messed everything up this year, so that we were only able to get back to work 2 weeks ago. And there is a script I'm working on now. I cannot tell you about it, because I don't talk about them until I've got my shooting date, and I don't have that yet.
Good enough.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been film director Sidney Lumet. His movies include 12 Angry Men, Porn Broker, Serpico, Prince of the City, Network, and The Verdict. His new film, Running on Empty, opens in September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the next Fresh Air, my guest will be Brian Wilson. He was the genius behind The Beach Boys. Now he has a new album. I hope you can join us.
I was sitting in a crummy movie with my hands on my...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yourself in Griffin Dunne and Amy Robinson's place. They were co-producers of the movie After Hours, in charge of the film's finances. But Dunne was also starring in the film, and the director, Martin Scorsese, wanted extra takes, and that meant spending more money. Coming up, Griffin Dunne and Amy Robinson tell us how they handled that and other movie production dilemmas. Also, rock historian Ed Ward explains how a rhythm and blues singer and his record label helped each other make it to the top of the charts. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg takes on those petty grammar rules called shibboleths and the people who use them as class weapons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. Senator Dan Quayle today labeled the latest reports about him just one bum rap after another. Quayle continued to be plagued by questions about his entry into the Indiana National Guard while preparing for his first solo trip as the Republican vice presidential candidate. Campaigning in Portland, Oregon today, George Bush defended his running mate. Bush also praised the record of the Reagan years, but said he would do a few things his own way. Neville Eschen of member station KOAP reports.
The Republican presidential hopeful volunteered comments on Dan Quayle, the hawkish senator whose Vietnam-era National Guard service is under fire.
I have my confidence in the new generation. I have my confidence in Dan Quayle. And wait till you see this guy on job training and on national defense. You'll be as proud of him as I am.
Vice President Bush reminded the crowd of around 2,000 of the recent agreement limiting a whole class of nuclear arms, an effort he said he'd continue, but he said he'd also work to ban chemical and biological weapons. Bush said he would do more for a clean environment, and he said he'd also make a good education a higher priority by expanding the Head Start program and rewarding good teachers. Bush also repeated his emphatic no to new taxes, and he touched on other conservative issues, support for voluntary school prayer and a strong national defense. For National Public Radio, I'm Neville Eschen in Portland, Oregon.
President Reagan left his California ranch today to attend a Republican fundraiser for Senator Pete Wilson. Using a spate of sports analogies, the president predicted a Bush-Quayle victory in November. He said Americans would not trade a winning team for third stringers with a weak defense, curveball campaign promises, and a set of policies to be named later. Democratic nominee Michael Dukakis used similar imagery during a news conference today, telling reporters the American people must decide who belongs in the major leagues and who belongs in the Bush leagues. There are reports from Poland that 125 miners today barricaded themselves in an underground shaft to press demands for higher pay and legalization of the outlawed Solidarity Trade Union. Meanwhile, some workers elsewhere reportedly ended their strike. The Polish government has threatened to impose martial law as it tries to quell the week-old wave of labor unrest, the worst in 7 years. President Reagan has signed historic trade reform legislation into law. Using the busy Long Beach port as a backdrop, Mr. Reagan hailed the measure passed overwhelmingly by the House and Senate. The president now says the government speaks as one, insisting on standards of fair play for U.S. products abroad.
This bill will help us continue our efforts to open markets. It'll help insist on standards of fair play for our products abroad. It'll strengthen the ability of U.S. firms to protect their patented, copyrighted, or trademarked goods and ideas from international thievery.
Many of the U.S.'s foreign trading partners see the new trade bill as protectionist. Consumer prices were up in July, while factory orders dropped. The Labor Department is reporting a 7% drop in demand for durable goods. That's the biggest decline in more than 4 years. But data resources economist Cynthia Latta says the drop in big-ticket items must be looked at in perspective with June's dramatic 8.7% increase.
That kind of increase we know isn't sustainable. We know it was a bulge in aircraft orders, so it simply is a retreat from that unsustainable high level, and orders are still at a high level. So there's nothing particularly worrisome there.
The Labor Department says the 0.4% hike in consumer prices is largely due to food price increases brought on by the drought. Leaders of the Palestinian uprising against Israel are calling on the PLO to adopt a clear political program to win support for their homeland cause. This is the first time the leadership in the occupied territories has made such an appeal. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped just a fraction, closing at 1989.33. Declines led advances 7-5 in trading of 119 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In music, as in most areas of our culture, success breeds imitation. In the post-war era, many young black singers tried to emulate the success of black vocalists like Nat King Cole and Louis Jordan. For the most part, the results sounded pretty generic. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says one record producer spotted a great talent among the imitators.
In 1935, a terrible 1-2 punch of tragedy hit Aretha Robinson, a young black woman who lived in Greensville, Florida. She had two sons, Ray, who was 5, and George, a year younger, and her husband was an itinerant railroad worker, so she had to raise them by herself. Fortunately, both kids were extraordinarily smart, especially George, who was a self-taught mathematical whiz. But one afternoon, George decided to go for a swim in a tub Aretha kept for rinsing the laundry she took in, and although he'd swum in it many times before, this time he drowned. Before the small family could recover from the shock, Ray discovered that a thick substance was coating his eyes, and a local doctor confirmed their worst fears. He was going blind. 2 years later, he was blind. He would have to attend a school for blind black children, and Aretha knew what that meant. He would be taught to beg or to make brooms. But Ray had an ace in the hole. He'd started playing the piano at the corner store. Before he left for school, she counseled him to stay away from the guitar they might try to teach him and concentrate on the piano. He followed her advice, and it's a good thing he did.
A sentimental blues will worry you and make you do things that you wouldn't do only when you hear these blues.
He was an excellent piano player, and his singing voice wasn't bad either. A young record distributor, Henry Stone, heard him singing in a nightclub one evening and brought him to the attention of a man named Jack Lauderdale, who owned Swing Time, a record label that specialized in sophisticated blues singers. Lauderdale liked what he heard and took Ray and his band, the Maxim Trio, into the studio to cut a bunch of records, including this one. Songs like Rockin' Chair Blues were all very nice, and in the backwoods honky-tonks that the Maxim Trio played, they must have been the height of sophistication. But Lauderdale saw right off that there were problems. One was that the band wasn't good enough for the piano player, and the other was that the piano player sounded just like Charles Brown, who, along with Nat King Cole, was the hottest black singer of the day. Oh, and his name, Ray Robinson, was getting him confused with the boxer who was getting so much publicity, Sugar Ray Robinson. His middle name would have to do for a last name, at least on stage, so Lauderdale's new star put out his next batch of records under his new name, Ray Charles.
Now don't put all your dreams in one basket. Don't put all your hope in one heart. For if you discover that she loves another, you'll be licked before you start.
And another thing, the kid thought he was good on these syrupy ballads, but he was sure no Nat Cole. The trouble was, funkier material didn't sell, except in the South, and Swing Time was looking for a national share of the growing black record market. The only people who liked the down-home stuff in the North were jazz buffs, record collectors like the two sons of the Turkish ambassador to the U.S., Ahmet and Neshwi Erdogan. They had a little record label of their own, Atlantic. Ahmet, in particular, seemed to be everywhere, and he'd heard of Ray Charles.
Down in St. Pete, Florida, how about my baby there? baby, there. No one's ever loved me like my baby. Any place, anywhere.
Songs like St. Pete, Florida, recorded live at a party, showed that Ray Charles had another voice, one Ahmet was itching to combine with an up-to-date jazz backup. But was Lauderdale going to let loose of his only star? The answer was yes. Lauderdale was almost broke, and he sold Ray's contract for $2,500.
The midnight hour have found me lonely, so unhappy as I can be.
At first, Ray insisted on singing in his old style, but they kept after him, and early in 1953, they made the breakthrough that launched a poor blind piano player from Florida and America's top rhythm and blues label simultaneously. Both Ray Charles and Atlantic Records had found their direction.
You can talk about the pit, barbecue. The band was jumping, the people too. I mess around. They're doing the mess around. They're doing the mess around. Everybody doing the mess around. Ah, everybody was juiced. You can bet your soul. They did the boogie woogie with a sturdy roll. They mess around. They're doing the mess around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Griffin Dunn and Amy Robinson make movies they would like to go see. They don't think of their movies as package deals or star vehicles, but as producers of four feature films with modest budgets, they work with some very interesting directors, Joan Micklyn Silver, John Sayles, and Martin Scorsese. Sidney Lumet directed their new film, Running on Empty, which is scheduled to open next month. It's about two radicals who went underground in the late 60s, and now their oldest son wants to stop living like a fugitive. Dunn and Robinson didn't become producers by rising through the ranks of some Hollywood studio. Dunn says there are no models for the way he and Amy Robinson operate.
I really can't think of very many examples of other producers that I can compare Amy and I to, because we came into it in such an odd route, that being that we were both actors, frustrated ones at that, and we became producers sort of right off the bat. But we were drawn to this profession by material. The material in the first case was a film directed by Joan Micklyn Silver called Chilly Scenes of Winter, and we were very taken with the material. It was a movie that we wanted to get made, and we really loved these characters, and we were fortunate enough to get it off the first time out.
I know that some producers insist that there's a certain amount of audience testing before a movie is let loose on the real movie-going public. And I was wondering if you ever indulge in that kind of thing in your films.
Well, it's not necessarily the producers as much as the studios that do that kind of thing. And they do it for different purposes. They do it for market research, and sometimes they do it for the actual content of the film. I think for market research, it may serve a purpose, I think, in terms of messing around with the content of your movie. It's not a very good idea.
I mean, you put your movie in the hands of an audience who, they look at the movie, they have an immediate reaction, they laugh in the right places or cry in the right places, hopefully. But then when it's all over, they're being given these cards with sort of essay questions about what did they least like about the movie, and then they have to really think about what they least liked about the movie and what they liked best, and it's sort of an unnatural environment. I mean, you can really only walk away with, you know, learning maybe 5 or 10% about your movie. The rest is really more for the studio.
What you really get more out of is sitting in the audience and just feeling the reaction.
Do you do that?
Yes.
Where do you like to go to feel the reaction?
Anywhere.
And then also we just sort of hang around by the door and listen to people talk about it when there aren't studio people asking them. You know, when they talk to their friends, you sort of get the real reaction.
You do so much as producers when you make a movie that I wonder if you're really skeptical of the theory, the auteur theory, when the auteur is seen as the director. You know, when it's seen that it's the, really the director who is the main person behind the movie.
Well, I do think that when you're a producer and when you develop material the way we do, at a certain point when a director comes onto the picture, you give it over in a lot of ways to the director. But hopefully that will be a very collaborative experience. I do believe film is a collaborative art form.
Is it hard for you when you get to that point where you've hired the director and in a way you're handing the film over to them?
Sometimes.
I was thinking it might be the kind of thing where you see the film as your baby and the director sees it as his or her baby.
Well, you hope that you're on the same track, mm-hmm. and that you don't feel that you're giving it over to someone who is now changing everything that you think is right. Then you've probably made the wrong decision in terms of the director.
I mean, our experience has always been, you know, knock on whatever this is here, wood, have always been really good. We've worked with very strong directors, Sales, Scorsese, and now Lumet, who really know what they want and are really assured about the kind of movie that they want to make. And luckily, it's they've always been, you know, in those cases, exactly the kind of movie we wanted to make. I think it's much better to turn your movie over in the hands of somebody who is assured and can really put their assurance and trademark on that film than to turn it over in the hands of someone who is less sure of themselves and is, you know, afraid of making choices.
One of the directors who you've worked with is Martin Scorsese. You produced the film After Hours, which he directed. Griffin, you starred in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Amy, you had starred in his first big film, Mean Streets.
Right.
I was wondering if it was awkward at all to be the producers of a movie directed by someone with the stature and talent of Scorsese, someone, Amy, who you had worked with and who I'm sure and some of you probably saw even as a teacher. Maybe that's being presumptuous.
Well, I think that it wasn't difficult, actually. It made things a lot easier in a lot of ways because I felt that I knew Marty quite well. Mm-hmm. I think when we were doing Mean Streets, we were all very young. I don't think I did think of Marty as a teacher. It was his third feature film, and he was very talented and energetic, but he, you know, was not an old master at that point.
Griffin, what's it like when you're producing a movie that you're also starring in? Every time you do an extra take, do you feel guilty because you're spending extra money on this extra take?
Not for a second.
But his partner makes him feel guilty.
Yeah, she tried to. That was actually, you put your finger on the only sort of, the major sort of conflict I had when I was producing After Hours and acting in it, during the acting, I just tried to not think about the producing. And Marty likes to shoot a lot of takes. But then I would go back to the trailer, and Amy and Bob Colesbury, our other partner, would ask me how many takes we did, and you know, tell me how much over we were on the film budget, and it would make me very nervous and anxious, which was also then good for the movie, and I get nervous and anxious, and then go and act for Marty. So it all sort of worked out pretty good.
I guess you were really lucky that the character is supposed to be nervous, anxious, and neurotic.
Exactly, I think they planned it.
Amy, how come you gave up acting when you started producing?
It was just kind of a natural progression. Once we started producing, my acting career wasn't going tremendously well, and I did do some acting after we had produced our first film, but I found that producing provided me with a lot more control over my life, and creatively, being involved with projects from the very beginning to the very end, right, to going to the movie theaters and see how they're playing with the audience and how many people are marching in was really exciting. With acting, you're involved very intensely with the middle of the process, and then your job is over, and you never know what's going to happen in the cutting room, and you really don't know what's happening on the other side. I think my personality is better on this side of the camera. I like to know what's going on all the time.
I think producing movies is one of those professions most associated with all the whole constellation of stress-related illnesses. What do you do to keep yourself calm in those instances when you know that that you're heading for going seriously over budget, or if you feel that the movie is temporarily in trouble?
I have developed stress-related problems since I became a producer. I didn't have those before, but you kind of just tell yourself, well, it's only a movie. And we've never been in the position yet, knock on whatever wood you knocked on, where we're going massively over budget. We try very, very hard to spend a lot of time in what they call pre-production, which is the planning of the movie, and trying to plan very well, because our budgets usually aren't that big and we don't have that kind of leeway of going wildly over budget.
That doesn't mean that you're not under stress once it's shooting, though, because I think Amy does too, have these terrible knots in our stomach from the first day of shooting to the last day of shooting. And it's, part of the producer's job, a major part of it, is to worry, is to plan, predict what terrible disasters could happen. And when you're in the middle of shooting, it's your worst fantasies are so vivid you get these knots in your stomach and... you just worry a whole lot and just hope it's all going to work out.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Film producers Griffin Dunn and Amy Robinson. Their new film, Running on Empty, is directed by Sidney Lumet. It opens in September. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with guest host Daniel Zwerdling. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, more on Dan Quayle today, who is still embattled. We're going to talk with a Vietnam veterans leader who says that maybe a lot of veterans at the Veterans of Foreign Wars convention in Chicago yesterday cheered Quayle as the vice presidential choice, but a lot of Vietnam vets especially are not at all happy with a presidential ticket.
Who are you speaking with?
John Kiley. He's co-chairman of the National Vietnam Veterans Coalition, which represents a couple hundred thousand veterans. Also, we're going to talk about the controversial American Medical Association proposal, which would say to doctors, look, you should tell patients who have AIDS lovers that the patient has AIDS, whether or not the patients want to tell their lovers or not.
Thanks, Danny. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says some grammarians get carried away with the technical rules of grammar called shibboleths.
The word shibboleth comes to us from a Hebrew word that means stream in flood, via the story of the battle between the Gileadites and the Ephraimites that's recounted in the book of Judges, chapter 12. And the Gileadites took the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites, and it was so that when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," the men of Gilead said unto him, "Art thou an Ephraimite?" If he said nay, then they said unto him, "Say now shibboleth." And he said sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. Then they laid hold on him and smote him at the fords of the Jordan, and there fell at that time of Ephraim 42,000. Those 40,000 Ephraimite casualties are nothing against the number of people who have fallen victim to modern shibboleths, those subtle points of grammar and usage which linguistic cognoscenti use to distinguish themselves from the rabble, and which make the language seem a kind of minefield to everybody else. I'm not talking here about the kinds of mistakes that the ordinary thoughtful writer can hope to avoid. To qualify as a shibboleth, a usage has to be based on some obscure point of logic or etymology which the average person could never be expected to be familiar with, and which makes no real difference to the sense of what's communicated. In this way, shibboleths can be known only to those people who are privy to a body of arcane lore that's passed along from one generation of language purists to the next. The list of English shibboleths is long and depressing. Don't split an infinitive. Don't use data as a singular noun. Don't begin a sentence with and or but. Don't use can I to ask permission. But no usage sends modern Gileadites to the barricades more quickly than the alleged misuse of hopefully as a sentence adverb, as in, hopefully the war will end soon. The story here goes that hopefully means in a hopeful manner, and so can be used properly only in a sentence containing a verb like say, as in, perhaps the rain will stop, he said hopefully. Now, to hear purists talk about the misuse of hopefully, you'd think it was on a par with spitting tobacco juice at a wedding. One writer says that it is slack-jawed, common, and sleazy. Another calls it barbaric, illiterate, offensive, damnable, and inexcusable. But really, this one is shibboleth all the way. In the first place, the logic of the rule is inconsistent. If you condemn this use of hopefully, then you ought to come down just as hard on the use of frankly in a sentence like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. But of course, nobody's bothered by that. What's more, this use of hopefully is really quite useful. How else would you convey the meaning of hopefully the war will end soon? I hope the war will end soon? No, that's too subjective. And as for it is to be hoped that the war will end soon, well, you've got to be kidding. These fetishes and superstitions should be dismissed as mere silliness. The trouble is that the purists have been using them for generations to browbeat people into thinking that the rights and wrongs of English usage are a kind of Eleusinian mystery that's accessible only to a privileged caste. But we can take some consolation in knowing that modern shibboleths cleave both ways. They reveal as much about the Gileadites as they do about the Ephraimites. The next time somebody tries to nail you on a hopefully or a split infinitive, you have every reason to suspect that you've run into that most insufferable of creatures, the language bore. Lay hold on him and smite him down at the ford of the Jordan. It'll do you both a world of good.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I talk with flutist Carol Winsens. Like James Galway and Jean-Pierre Rampal, Winsens is a champion of her instrument. She organizes flute festivals and has expanded the repertoire by commissioning new works. In honor of Leonard Bernstein's 70th birthday, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Bernstein Songbook. It's a compilation of some of the composer's best-known works. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Telling of Lies by Timothy Finley. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.